Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, March 11th, 2024, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebig with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska.
And I'm Guy Iroh, and this week we're talking about a very important forage fish species, the capelin.
And I am very pleased to introduce our guests. We've got research ecologist Yumi Arimitsu with the USGS Alaska Science Center's Seabird and Forage Fish Ecology Program. And we've got seabird biologist Rob Kaler with the Marine Bird Section of our Division of Migratory Bird Management. So very warm welcome to both of you. We're happy to do a crossover with birds finally. I think this will be a new direction.
Yeah, thanks for looping in the birds.
So this is going to be a really neat episode because we're talking about a fish that's extremely important to a lot of other wildlife, notably seabirds here in Alaska. And to kick things off, we'd really like to get to know the fish. Yumi, I'm hoping you can help us first by describing what a capelin looks like.
Sure, I'd love to. So the capelin is a small pelagic forage fish. It tends to be about 12 to 15 centimeters long when it is fully mature. It has an adipose fin, so that's a nice characteristic.
Yeah.
And one of the most distinctive things about it is that it smells like cucumber.
So Delta smelt also smells like cucumber. Are these guys related?
Yes, these are both members of the Osmerid family, and there are other smelts that also smell like capelin. The rainbow smelt is another one that occurs in Alaska, and that cucumber smell is pretty distinct.
We've talked about Delta smelt on the show. We're trying to talk about rainbow smelt sometime. And so a lot of these guys kind of mixed freshwater, saltwater life history. Is this exclusively a marine fish, or do you ever see it up into freshwater?
It is exclusively a marine fish, but in places that I've worked, like glacial fjords in Alaska, they certainly do occur in these areas where there's lots of glacial freshwater runoff. So they tend to be quite capable of handling more brackish water. They're spawning on beaches near freshwater outflows often. But I'm not aware of them actually migrating up into rivers.
When you say they're spawning on beaches, are you talking about just in the shallows? Or are they actually coming up onto the beach at all?
They're coming up onto the beach. And so that's one of the cool things about capelin is that they are beach spawners. The males will come inshore as they're preparing to spawn. And so you'll have just this massive kind of shoal just right near the shoreline. The males develop this ridge along their lateral line. This apparently helps them to kind of get up into the beach sediments and the females come in and lay their eggs. We tend to see many fewer females during these spawning aggregations. You'll see a lot of males that kind of get washed up on the shore during these events.
Where are these fish found and how does their range and behavior intersect with seabirds?
They're found really down to BC in the North Pacific, so down to BC, Canada. But they don't occur there very much anymore. We see spawning and aggregations occurring mainly starting in Southeast Alaska and where Rob and I work actually more in South Central Alaska, where we know that seabirds are very interested in the capelin. So we see them picking up capelin out of schools in their feeding flocks, really all over Alaska. They do also occur up into the Bering Sea and the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas to the very north, and they're circumpolar in their distribution. They actually occur all the way over to the Atlantic, and there are commercial fisheries for them in the Barents Sea. There's an Iceland population near Iceland and Greenland, and then also in Newfoundland. So we know lots about the fish where they are in their Atlantic distribution, where there are commercial fisheries for them.
Yeah.
But in Alaska, they're such an important forage species, so they have prohibited directed fisheries on most forage species, including capelin, in Alaska.
Rob, I'm hoping you can describe a few seabirds for us, like what they look like, what their size is, and how they're adapted for eating fish like capelin.
Murres are kind of the big one that come to mind. They're pursuit diving piscivorous, meaning they eat fish. and they can dive to great depths. There's other species such as puffins, you know, tufted and horned puffins, also enjoying anything beneficial like a capelin, so high in nutrients and caloric value. Kittiwakes, they're plunge diving, but not as deep as a puffin or a mer. What's needed metabolically by these birds? One of the examples is mers. They weigh about 1,000 grams. They're black and white. Generally, most seabirds are a blend of black and white. They consume somewhere between 30% of their body weight.
Oh, wow.
On a daily basis. And so depending on the nutritional value of that fish, that could be anywhere from 30 fish to 100 fish, maybe even 300 fish, especially if they're small. And that's just to meet their daily metabolic rate. There's a junk food hypothesis. So if they're eating something like a very young of the year pollock, for example, in a warm year, they have to work a lot harder. And particularly, I think for mers, when these fish school together tightly, they can forage much more efficiently. During warmer water conditions, you might get less schooling of these fish. And so now these mers are working harder to meet their metabolic daily rates.
1,000 grams. I'm always kind of surprised with these seabirds. They seem smaller when you actually see them in person. How big is that? And how big is like a puffin, maybe with a weight that's not in grams?
Yeah. How about a really big football? Okay. But they are very light, you know, their bones themselves are hollow. Yumi, do you have a 1,000 gram comparison?
Well, over 2 pounds.
Is that like a block of cheese? I don't know.
It's a couple pounds.
A big block of cheese. How's that?
There you go. Awesome.
So these fish, if they're migrating for spawning or migrating to feeding grounds, do you have birds that migrate to follow the capelin, or do they just wait till they return?
During the breeding season, they lay one egg, specifically talking about mers. They don't breed every year, and they probably don't start breeding till they're 3 or 4. And then they're what we consider central place foragers. So they go and they locate a food source, and there's an idea that they might even be information exchanging as they come to and from their colonies. And these colonies can range from hundreds to thousands to 10,000 plus. And so there's an idea that they might actually be tracking where other birds are returning. And they do carry the fish crosswise in their bill. Unlike an auklet, which consumes plankton or zooplankton, have a gular sac, the same for puffins as well, carrying the fish crosswise in their bill. So it's possible that they might be visually seeing where other birds have been.
The seabirds are actually telling us where the fish are. Because we don't have targeted commercial fisheries for any forage fish besides herring. There are some inshore fisheries for herring in Alaska, but really, you know, the sand lance and the capelin, these other really preferred species, high quality, small pelagic schooling fish. We don't have a lot of information about where they're going, changes in their migratory behavior that might be causing major changes that we see. Capelin is actually one of the species that's quite prone to collapse. So many of these species will have kind of a boom and bust population trajectory. That's one of the things that makes it so hard for fisheries biologists to really get a handle on what's happening with the capelin. But the seabirds, they tell us something. We can almost see the capelin through the lens of the seabird. One of the important parts of sort of the capelin story in Alaska is that capelin crashed. They collapsed from an all-time high. Their population went from as high as we've ever seen it to almost completely disappeared. This was during the marine heat wave that occurred. Some people have called it the blob. It was a major food web disruptor. It lasted about 2 years, from 2014 to 2016. It actually started in late 2013. And we just had this long period of extremely warm temperatures. And capelin are known to be really a canary of the sea. They're very tied to cooler water temperatures. And in the Gulf of Alaska, it's really, you know, kind of the lower latitude of their range. And so we think that this capelin collapse that occurred sometime between 2014 and 15, it also occurred with a massive seabird die-off, and the common mer specifically. We think that 1 or more million birds died during this marine heat wave. Capelin is like this indicator. They're an early warning signal. But the thing is that we can't see the capelin as well as we can see the birds. So when those birds started washing up on the shore in 2015 and 16, when we had them all the way from Southern California to the Bering Sea and into the Arctic, washing up dead, this was an indication that something major was happening in the marine ecosystem. It was really centered in the Gulf of Alaska, right where Rob Kaler and I work. And we really saw the effects of that there. I think capelin are certainly a major part of this story because they seem to just have been this important prey item and then all of a sudden had disappeared from the ecosystem.
Do you know if the capelin died off or if they just sought cooler waters further north in the Arctic? And if so, how do you know it was one or the other?
There has been a lot of work coming out of the NOAA NIMS surveys in the Bering Sea. They documented a very clear contraction of capelin distribution in the Bering Sea. There had been some cooling that occurred in the years prior to 2013. And they had documented really over about 20 years an expansion of capelin in the Bering Sea. And then during those really warm years, they contracted their distribution right around the northern area near St. Lawrence Island. And you could really see from their surveys that it looked like a mortality event of capelin, not so much just them moving north, but they had very much contracted their distribution. We know less about it in the Gulf of Alaska, but one of the key indicators that we have to track the availability of capelin to certain predators is seabird diets. There's a little colony near the shelf break in the Gulf of Alaska, Northern Gulf, and it's called Middleton. And Scott Hatch, he was a researcher with the Fish and Wildlife Service and USGS, and now he goes out and has sampled seabird diets there since '88. He has done an amazing job to document how seabird diets have changed over time. It's really one of the best ways that we have continuous time series information about seabird use of capelin in this region. We tend to see some kind of oscillation between capelin and their counterpart, which is sand lance. Sand lance tend to thrive in warmer conditions, whereas capelin tend to thrive in cooler conditions. We certainly see that in the seabird diet information. You know, one of the concerning things is that really the capelin and sand lance were previously the most important species for the seabird diets, rhinoceros auklets, also kittiwakes, which are being monitored there. Since the heat wave, we just haven't seen the same kind of use of either of these two species. We're concerned for both of them.
What else are you seeing in their diets?
They've replaced it with things like young of the year sablefish. We see more herring and more greenling. There's been some kind of pulse of young of the year greenling in seabird diets lately. We think that they're actually going farther from their colonies in some of these years to be accessing different foraging habitats.
So less optimal foraging, perhaps.
Yeah. If they're going twice as far to get herring and juvenile salmon, it's not as much bang for the buck when they can just go for capelin and sand lance that used to occur closer to the colony. We don't know as much about adult diets as we do chicks. They have to select the best food they can. That's why these small schooling pelagic fish tend to be really high quality chick food.
Yeah. I'm curious. You always see those pictures of puffins with lots of fish hanging out of their beaks. How are they collecting more than one fish at a time? How are they catching them and holding on to all those fish?
I think they have a very talented tongue and they're just really skilled fishers. Yeah, they're top notch. And a lot of those, I think, are going to be sand lance that you see. But yes, very impressive. I think they have a talent unique to them to capture that many and then go and continue foraging for additional.
Yeah, it's always kind of blows my mind.
In the back of their mouth, that they are actually able to store the fish that they've already caught behind and then go try to catch more. So that's how the rhino auklets and the tufted puffins, the horned puffins, can have multiple prey, lots of fish just hanging out of their mouth. That little trap door in the back.
And most of what we know about seabird diets is based on what they're bringing back to their young.
How are you going about quantifying the diets of these chicks?
That's a great question. MERS will carry a single fish back to their colony to feed to their chicks. The rhinoceros auklets, they carry them crosswise in their bill, but they bring back these whole, fresh, ray fish samples. The researchers at Middleton Island and other Fish and Wildlife Service refuge colonies that are monitored, they are intercepting the birds on their way to their burrows where the chicks are. And the birds drop all the prey items. We scoop them up and then we get to measure them. We can identify them. We can archive those samples. We're looking at energy density of different prey items. We're looking at over the course of the chick rearing season, how species are growing based on their length and weight. So there's lots of information the seabirds are telling us.
Intercept is a fun scientist word there. What does that specifically mean?
At the Middleton Field Station, they have a system where they go out at night, and when the birds come in and they land and then they're running into their burrow, the scientists are able to grab them on their way in. And so that's how they get those. We've done this at puffin colonies all along the Aleutians. Sometimes we put little screens over burrows. So when the puffin comes in with its bill load, it gets to its burrow and it sees there's a screen on there. It can't get in the burrow, and its instinct is to drop its bill load and then go out and get a new one. So basically, we're monitoring these screens. And as soon as the bird leaves the meal, we go pick it up and
check it out.
And yep. And then we have our sample, which is great. And then we take the screens off of the burrow and the parent can deliver the next meal with no problem.
So the burrow nesters, the puffins, rhinoceros auklets, which is also a puffin, and then corn puffins, tufted puffins, they're burrow nesters. So we can do that in the ledge nesters like kittiwakes or murres.
Yeah. And beyond when they're on land with their chicks, they spend the rest of their life at sea, correct? And that's why it's difficult to sample them out there.
Yeah. 9 months at sea, 3 months on shore. And even on shore, they're just coming and going.
I think it's really neat that seabirds can help us sample fish. We learned how the Lancet fish stomachs that their observers are taking off the tuna long lines. They're learning a lot about food webs to those fish, just given the difficulty of sampling these ecosystems and all these changes. I think it's really neat that seabirds help with that.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And in Alaska, we've just been compiling all the data that we can find about capelin, whether it be in seabird diets, whether it be in groundfish diets. There's lots of groundfish diet information that NOAA collects along with their surveys for the commercial species. So they're finding them in Pacific cod diets and in their stomach contents. But we're also compiling to look at how the predators are telling us similar or different things than the net surveys. So there's bottom trawls and beach seines and midwater trawls. And we're trying to put all that information together. We find that there is a lot of value in looking across all these what would seem disparate data sets, but they're telling us a similar story about how capelin have changed in their abundance and distribution over time. And we're seeing a lot of similarities, especially between the seabird diets and the net surveys in terms of where the capelin are and how many there are. So it's actually been quite interesting to see that the birds are telling us the same thing that nets would be telling us as well.
Along, everyone. It's me, Maria, and time for your Minute with Maria. I wanted to give a big shout out and big, huge kagasakung to our guests for talking with us today. It's really interesting to me to see all of the collaborative efforts that are going into science and research for fish, for birds, for the whole ecosystem. And this is a wonderful example of co-stewardship on all levels with Fish and Wildlife, collaborating with USGS, collaborating on the ship, the TIGLA, out in the Aleutians and the Alaska Maritime Refuge to get a better understanding of this fish and the birds that eat them and the predators that also eat the forage fish as well. So big, huge thank you for coming to talk to us and letting us in on the research that you're doing. It's really incredible to hear. And as a Unangak from the Aleutians myself, I am just so fascinated by what this fish is doing in particular. this is a really good lesson about if we really listen to the birds and the animals, we can hear the story that it tells. So thank you for sharing this story with us. And I can't wait to hear more.
I'd like to introduce krill to the conversation as well. It's not a fish, it's a copepod, but very, very energy important. And as Yumi pointed out, much of what we know about seabird diets is based on what they're feeding their young. You know, krill, herring, sand lance, and capelin, those are the big four.
They kind of are driving a lot of the forage fish. Krill are euphausids. These are considered macrozooplankton. They look pretty much like tiny little shrimp. They occur in these massive clouds in the water column. Capelin love to eat euphausids. Euphausids are also eaten by humpback whales and the baleen whales. They're just important in driving so much of the food web. The biomass of euphausids, when you add it up, tends to be quite large. And they're such an important component of the food chain that, yes, we do often call them the other forage fish.
What role, if any, does the presence of sea ice play in deriving the food web in the Arctic systems?
Sea ice is important because there tends to be a lot of phytoplankton production that occurs right where the sea ice is receding. And you also have some sea ice algae that can promote the primary production level of the food chain. Our colleague George Devoki has been working up near Utqiagvik, and he has been monitoring a colony there for a long time. And he's shown that the food of the black guillemot is really so important to their ability to make chicks and to fledge chicks, and that the distance of the sea ice edge to the colony totally is important. And in fact, the Arctic cod are a very high energy resource for those birds. The distance of the sea ice from the colony is really what's causing the changes in the composition of the food those birds are bringing to their chicks. And he's seen a big decline because the sea ice edge has moved very far offshore. He's seen declines in the colony of the adults, in the reproductive capabilities, and really is that to the food there.
Oh, man.
The algae associated with sea ice is really critical. And what Yumi's talking about and George Devoki's work off of Utqiagvik at Cooper Island is really a classic example of the retraction of the sea ice, which, you know, the salinity, how it affects the chemistry of the ocean, the water, you know, holding on to heat for longer. And of course, the native folks and local villages in the Bering Strait region know this very well. That lack of a cold pool, this curtain of cold water, that's what kept walleye, pollock, and Pacific cod further south. And in 2018, 2019, a northern migration of these two species, biomass was quadrupled, even more than that. And now they're competing for the same resources that marine birds and marine mammals are consuming.
Wow.
A real big challenge. And John Pyatt, he's USGS Alaska Science Center retired, but talking about this ectothermic vice, basically top-down pressure and then bottom-up. And now they're all competing with this increased biomass of cod and pollock, you know, which are commercially harvested or managed.
Yeah, yeah. I have to ask both of you, are you team bird or team fish, and why?
They're interconnected. There's top-down, there's bottom-up. So I'm team Yumi myself.
I want a straight answer from you, Rob.
Jen, I'm pretty sure Rob is actually team bird. And
I'm pretty sure too. It was a
trick question for Rob. Team fish. It's why Rob and I work pretty well together.
That's what I thought. Could you both just give a kind of brief overview of where you work and what the goals of your office is?
I work for USGS, Alaska Science Center. I am leading the seabird and forage fish ecology program under the ecosystems mission. So it's our job to provide information to resource managers, especially in the DOI, regarding ecosystem dynamics. We're certainly interested in migratory birds and helping folks like Rob Kaler to understand status and trends and kind of drivers of those trends. We're interested in endangered species. We've done a lot of work on kitlets and smearlets, and it turns out that capelin is a really key prey for those species as well. So capelin brings together the whole ecosystem in many respects.
Okay. And DOI, that's Department of Interior. So yes. Agencies like Fish and Wildlife Service, Park Service.
Bureau of Ocean Energy Management.
Yeah. So Rob Kaler with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Migratory Bird. I'm by the airport on the unceded lands of the Dena'ina peoples. We complement some of our other programs within U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Ecological Services, more regulatory but endangered species, in addition to refuges. We're very fortunate, Alaska, to have a pretty substantive refuge system. Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, of course, has the vast majority of seabirds and seabird colonies. We complement some of the work that Maritime and the other refuges are doing, monitoring birds on the colonies.
Okay. Awesome.
We work at sea, conducting surveys with partners like UMI or NOAA or even the U.S. Coast Guard, putting seabird observers on there as they do ocean chemistry, ocean mapping, bathymetry, and stuff like that.
Awesome. We heard from Lauren Flynn recently on our Lancet Fish episode, and she mentioned she was looking for rat latrines when she came across her first Lancet fish on the beach. And I'm wondering if you could speak just quickly about rats on islands and impacts to seabirds.
Kiska Island is a huge example. So Kiska is in the West Aleutians, has a very large auklet colony there that's very impacted by rats. The Alaska Maritime Refuge has done an amazing job removing rats where possible. They continue to think about ways and collaborate with partners on how to remove invasive rats, as well as educating folks. So places like the Pribilof Islands, St. Paul and St. George, and keeping people prudent and vigilant about, because ships coming in can have rats aboard. We consider the Pribilof Island kind of the Galapagos Islands of the North, high density of breeding seabirds. And so one rat could have a huge impact.
How do they impact birds? What are they doing exactly?
I was doing some puffin diet collections on colonies out at Attu, the westernmost Aleutian island. We found that rats had come in, and it was actually really devastating to see, because they had gone into the burrows and they had pulled out the chicks, killed the chicks. Like the chicks had been damaged, but not necessarily eaten. It was pretty horrific, the damage that had been done there. Luckily, we have some real heroes out there doing the rat eradication. And in fact, our friend Stacy Buckaloo worked on eradicating rats from the Rat Islands, so much so that they had to rename them. So it was a really good story in the end.
Any calls to action from the public in terms of sending in their observations or participating as citizen scientists or anything like that?
I do. Thank you for asking that question. So one of the things that we're really interested in is any observations of capelin spawning on beaches. I've been just asking for information like a latitude, a longitude, maybe a photo, the date. And if possible, if it's a fresh spawn, these spawns can happen anytime between May and into August in South Central Alaska. Southeast, we've seen them anytime between April and September. And we're getting to understand a lot more about the species, and especially their spawning age structure and when they're maturing and how that's changed really since the marine heat wave. If anybody ever has information about where they're seeing capelin spawning anywhere in Alaska, we would be really happy for that information.
Rob, anything from you in terms of seabird observations or die-offs?
The expansive coastline of Alaska makes it very hard, and if not impossible, to monitor seabirds washing up ashore, dead and dying. And we are concerned about harmful algal blooms as warming ocean temperatures increase the rate of the frequency of a harmful algal bloom, saxitoxin, for example. But also we've got bird flu, coastal observation, seabird survey team. They're based out of the University of Washington. They've been a huge partner, as well as Alaska Sea Grant, reporting those observations. We also have a bird flu hotline within Fish and Wildlife Service that should be pretty easy to locate online, but remain vigilant, report observations. It's very helpful in tracking the duration. How long are these seabird die-offs happening? The geographic scope, is it from Bristol Bay up into the Bering Strait? Is it in the Gulf of Alaska? And then as well as which species are being impacted? Is it the auklets that are eating the plankton, or is it forage fish species like the mer, or is it all of them? And that's what we've seen since 2015. Yumi referred to the blob, the marine heat wave 2014 to 2016. There is also a small heat wave up in the Bering Strait. Well, small relative to that Gulf of Alaska in terms of duration, but 2018, 2019. Report your observations. The LEO network is an excellent way to share out. Yeah.
Awesome. What other fish should we cover that are important to birds?
Brill.
Sablands is the other one that we haven't talked about, but it's a key player. It's not just birds. They're a key prey for Chinook and other salmon species. And they're one that gets even less attention than capelin or herring. So highly recommend a sandland show someday in the future.
At greenlands, kelp greenlands, studying pigeon guillemots at Naked Island in Prince William Sound, a lot of their diet was composed of kelp greenling. And when they're at their juvenile stages, I think they're hard to identify to species, but I think they're probably contributing a lot.
We've had a resurgence of greenling. Interesting thing is that I was watching Taka Watanuki, who is a Japanese researcher who studies rhino auklet diets in Japan. He said he saw also a similar increase in greenlings in rhino auklet.
Oh, interesting.
Following the heat wave. Yeah, it seems to be maybe all the way across the North Pacific.
When I was studying kitlets is in the West Aleutians and Central Aleutians, I just referred to them as hexagramids, but we call them the blue back. These are fairly large size forage fish, which I assume are some kind of greenling. And Bouldir Island, which is one of the long-term sites that Alaska Maritime has been monitoring since the late 70s, I think they see a fair bit of greenling in there in the diets.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you both. This was super fascinating, and it's really neat to learn about all the connections that capelin create. Appreciate you all very much. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay. Well, get out there and live with, live from, discover, and enjoy all the fish, especially those forage fish like capelin and krill. Be sure to send your capelin spawning observations to the USGS Alaska Science Center and report your seabird die-off observations as well. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Iroh. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.
What are the penguins eating?
Oh, the penguins are eating similar things. The thing, what is interesting is that the mers are kind of like the penguin of the north because they are black and white. And I've actually had lots of people ask me if these are penguins that we're studying. But of course, penguins are flightless and they only occur in the southern hemisphere. So so those are big differences.
I like to ask to hit a nerve with the seabird biologists that I've talked to.
Penguins. There's a Gary Larson cartoon where he shows a polar bear wearing a penguin mask. And one of the penguins says to the other penguin, "Something's not right here. Where's George?" And it's really, there's no polar bears around penguins. So Gary Larson got in a lot of trouble for that one.